Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. We recently reported that the federal government and consequently Wyoming might be getting shortchanged when it comes to royalty payments on coal going overseas. Turns out the government is missing out on royalties in other ways, too. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports that right here in Wyoming, companies are quite literally burning up both federal and state royalty money when they flare natural gas.
A flare is used to burn off natural gas that, for whatever reason, can't be captured. The flare stacks stand like giant candles by the well sites and sound like this. The practice has led to environmental and health concerns, but in addition to those problems, there's also the issue of money. If operators are just burning the stuff instead of selling it, do the mineral owners still get paid? The answer is no. No one gets paid. Historically, the state hasn't seen so much flaring, but lately, the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has started allowing companies to flare beyond the standard testing period of about 15 days for new wells. Director of the Office of State Lands and Investments, Ryan Lance, says royalties aren't applied because it's not considered waste. For example, it's not waste if the flaring is an emergency or is part of well testing.
But then there's this other more broad application that operators can submit that then is really the evidentiary discussion that they have with either the supervisor or the commission. And they have to lay out the reasons for the flaring, the duration, and the estimated volumes.
Basically, that technical waste definition can be flexible when considering the flaring extension permits, if there's a good reason.
Most importantly for our determination is how far are you away from a pipeline.
And here's the issue. The relatively new oil plays in the state are being developed for the lucrative oil. The gas is just a byproduct, one for which there's limited infrastructure in place, and one for which prices are so low that there isn't a huge motivation to get the separate gas pipelines built. Wyoming Petroleum Association President Bruce Hinchey says the economics of building the gas pipelines don't make sense.
There's just not enough gas to pay for the pipeline, so therefore it's a product that's not going to get sold. I guess if you want to pay a royalty on it, it's just going to reduce the amount of revenue to the operator and to the state.
It's true that if operators are made to pay royalties on gas or just flaring off, they will be parting with more money. The state's loss, in Hinchey's statement, is based on the old adage that if operators are taxed more, they will drill less or go elsewhere, thereby contributing less overall revenue to the state. But there's also evidence showing that the state stands to gain. Because there's no money in flaring now, how much has flared off isn't tracked carefully, and nobody really ever did the math on how much money was being lost, until Lance did some rough calculations.
We've seen that one operator and nine wells on state trust lands flare volumes that would be equal in terms of a royalty rate on a $3 gas price, about $189,440. If you add severance taxes on that at the 6% rate, the amount of severance taxes on those nine wells would be $68,000. $197.
There's also an ad valorem tax that would increase total gain. That's over 2 years for wells flaring from 2010 to 2012. Lance recognizes that those numbers aren't huge, but he adds this.
If you multiply that over time, we're talking about real money, especially when you consider the budget picture that we face today in the state with declining revenues or at least static revenues. These are wasting assets that frankly, we never get a chance at again, and we better get it right.
Currently, there are 65 wells with flaring extension permits. The vast majority are for over 100 days, with 11 for a full year. 10 are on state lands, while the rest are in federal and fee lands. The federal policy is very similar to the state policy, so the feds are losing out too. One thing that makes state trust land leases different, though, is that they directly and almost exclusively support schools.
These are resources that are non-renewable, that support public education, and basically by condoning flaring and not collecting a royalty on that gas stream, we're giving that up forever, and we're doing that in the context of supporting public education.
Interim Supervisor of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, Bob King, says that it's not the commission's role to add cost to a company's production even when the state's losing money.
We certainly can't dictate that a company be forced to lay a pipeline to a well if it's not a viable project on their end.
In other words, King, who determines whether a company can drill or not, is not willing to take a stand on this issue.
That issue, I don't know if it would be appropriate for the regulatory agency to take a position on it one way or the other.
However, King is apparently thinking about this issue. He opened the commission's most recent hearing with concerns regarding flaring and said the commission staff was looking at requiring more diligent monthly reporting of flared volumes from operators. A clarification of rules about a year ago has led to more transparency about flaring, if not more money from industry. And the Revenue Committee is looking at the tax side of the issue, which would inevitably include a conversation about royalties as an interim topic. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Wyoming Republican lawmakers are up in arms over efforts by the Obama administration to regulate carbon emissions through the executive branch. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on the energy debate that's boiling on Capitol Hill.
Congress is so divided in Washington that lawmakers are struggling to pass relatively mundane agenda items, like a budget. The highly polarized atmosphere makes big-ticket items, such as tackling climate change, non-starters. That's why President Obama is vowing to address global warming without congressional input. Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says sentiments like that are eroding public confidence in government.
The American people, when asked, do you believe that the government is acting with the consent of the governed, which is, of course, a founding principle, the vast majority say no.
The Obama administration claims it doesn't need new congressional authority to curb carbon pollution because a past Congress already granted that authority. In 1970, lawmakers passed the Clean Air Act, which is aimed at curbing hazardous pollutants. The chair of the Senate Environment Committee, Barbara Boxer of California, is a leading advocate of addressing climate change. But she says the work of the legislative branch is largely done.
We passed the Clean Air Act. It is the law of the land. Laws are to be obeyed. And the executive, in my view, has no option but to carry out the law.
Lummis begs to differ.
Yeah, I completely disagree with that statement and reject that statement. Congress cannot surrender its authority to make law to federal agencies.
However, courts have ruled that the Clean Air Act gives the executive branch authority to curb carbon pollution. Chairwoman Boxer says that means the only chance Republicans like Lummis have of stopping the administration is by passing another law or by undoing the Clean Air Act.
They can't overturn it. They tried to. We stood sentry the last few years, and we stopped them from turning back the clock. They tried to pass legislatively a law that said that greenhouse gas emissions were not covered under the Clean Air Act, and we beat them back, and we've beat them back continually.
Wyoming Senator John Barrasso says the White House is abusing its authority because officials know that their climate agenda has no chance of passing this Congress.
We're going to continue to fight against an effort by the administration to try to regulate what they can't pass legislatively. You know, the legislation ought to be proposed and passed in Congress that Congress thinks is in the best interest of the American people. It shouldn't be the president going way beyond the original intent of things like the Clean Air or the Clean Water Act and using them in ways they were never intended to be used.
It's no secret that the debate over greenhouse gas emissions is about more than health and the climate. It's also about jobs. Environmentalists like Mike Brune of the Sierra Club argue taking aggressive action on climate change will help bring the U.S. economy back to life.
It will create 350,000 new jobs and sustain at least 100,000 more. It will help to weatherize 1 million homes per year, which will act like a tax cut and help consumers to save money all across the country.
While Wyoming is ripe for renewable energy sources like wind, its economy is also dependent on its fossil fuel industry. Senator Barrasso says having politicians pick winners and losers in the energy debate could hurt the state's traditional energy sources.
People in Wyoming are appropriately concerned about so many wonderful jobs in Wyoming connected to the energy and energy exploration and providing affordable energy to all Americans.
With jobs at stake back home, Wyoming's lawmakers are some of the most vocal in the energy debate going on in Washington. But if Wyoming Republicans can't overturn the law, what can they do? One of their best chances is through funding, or more precisely, defunding. In the latest government funding battle, Republicans were able to cut about $90 million from the Environmental Protection Agency, which the president was forced to accept. Lummis says that's just a first step.
So we're going to be working hard to push back, to have appropriate regulation that is in place and was legally enacted, and that is not arbitrary, not capricious, and certainly not contrary to law.
Many say the battle over climate change will be decided in court, which means there's likely to be more questions than answers facing the energy sector and lawmakers in the coming years. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we'll hear about managing fossils on public lands and a new story in our series Upstarts on Wyoming Entrepreneurs. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. When we think about the Bureau of Land Management, dinosaurs and other ancient creatures are not necessarily the first things that come to mind. But the agency has a small team of paleontologists whose job it is to manage fossils on public land. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden spoke with one of those paleontologists, Brent Breithaupt. He's based right here in Wyoming, and he says public land in the West is full of fossils, many of which have not been discovered yet.
So it's my responsibility to help manage, to protect, preserve the fossils, the paleontological resources on these lands for this generation and future generations of our public.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that when a project of some sort is going on, oil drilling, gas drilling, something like that, somebody stumbles across a fossil, that's when they call you and say, hey, we found something?
Well, the BLM's mandate is for multiple use. So when we take a look at my program, dealing with fossils, what that means is that any sort of impact to fossils on public lands, and that can range from a researcher, a scientist from another university coming out to Wyoming, or those from the University of Wyoming going and doing work in the state. I work with them to make certain that proper permits are applied for, that proper authorizations are provided for their work. In addition, any type of impact to the surface. So if there's going to be a pipeline, if there's going to be a mine, what would be the impact to the resources there? So we work with a variety of different types of consulting paleontologists who also are permitted to go out and survey these areas, to do mitigation on these areas as the disturbance is ongoing.
What are some of the most interesting projects that you've worked on in this role, interesting fossils that you've been dealing with, things like that?
Probably some of the most interesting activities that I'm associated with are some of the activities related to dinosaur discoveries in the state. And that can range from dinosaur bones and teeth, but also it relates to dinosaur footprints. And one of the sites that we have done a lot of work on over the years and we have promoted quite heavily is the 165-million-year-old Red Gulch Dinosaur Track site in northern Wyoming outside of Grable. That particular site led to an understanding of what Wyoming was like during the Middle Jurassic, about 165 million years ago, when the land was at sea level, was in ancient tidal flats, and there were hundreds of small to medium-sized meat-eating dinosaurs walking across this ancient tidal flat, leaving their footprints. And what's exciting about it is those footprints are still preserved today.
How did you find these tracks?
These tracks were found by a geologist and his relatives in the Bighorn Basin. And they were out observing some of the exposed rocks out there, and they reported it to the BLM. And in fact, that's generally how we like people to proceed when they come across important finds. There's lots of fossils in Wyoming. I mean, this is a fantastic place to be a paleontologist because we have so many incredible fossils here, ancient oysters and squid remains. We have lots of plant remains. We have palm leaves. We have ancient tropical trees and of course, we have the various kinds of vertebrate animals. We have some of the earliest horses here. And then, of course, we have the dinosaurs. And if fossils are found on public lands, we encourage people to take a look at them, to photograph them, to note where they're found. And if they think they found something rare or significant, they need to contact the nearest Bureau of Land Management office and let them know that they've made a discovery, because there's many, many discoveries yet to be found.
What happens when you do find a really important or rare fossil? Is that something that you would then bring to a museum ultimately?
Well, if there was a very rare fossil discovered, and there are rare fossils discovered, generally the procedure would be that once these are reported to the Bureau of Land Management, then we would contact our research partners. We work with researchers from around the country. We would contact one of them, presumably a researcher that has interests in that particular kind of fossil, so whether it be a fossil horse or a dinosaur, or let's say it's an early type of fossil plant that's of scientific importance. We would contact the particular researcher who has a research specialty in that and let them know about it and say, here's a new discovery, here's a new site. When you come out in the summer, and many of them come out on a regular basis, you may want to take a look at this site. And then we determine what the next step would be. Some fossils are collected. Some fossils are left in place. And the ones that are left in place are generally dinosaur footprints, generally are dinosaur track sites. And we have many of these throughout the West.
Why is it so important to have somebody doing what you're doing for the BLM?
Having paleontologists within the BLM allows the BLM to be able to help manage, protect, preserve parts of our natural heritage. Fossils are part of our natural heritage. We've got an incredible, rich diversity of fossils found out on BLM lands. In particular, in Wyoming, we have some of the oldest fossils in North America here, dating back to 2 billion years ago, when Wyoming was under a sea, when we had ancient blue-green algae living in the shallow seaways. We have animals that lived during the ice ages, like the mammoths here. We have everything from the plants to the sea animals to the land animals to the animals that flew in the skies, like the birds, the pterosaurs, the flying reptiles. We have evidence of when Wyoming was at sea level, below sea level, and at elevation similar to today. We have evidence of how Wyoming has changed through time. The seas came in, the seas went out, the seas came in, the seas went back out again. The mountains rose up, they weathered down, the mountains rose up again. And we have animals and plants that reflect these environments, these changes of environments. These are parts of America that are scientifically and educationally important. These are parts of America's heritage that are irreplaceable. These are parts of America's heritage that are exciting to learn about, to tell people about, and provide very, very important information with regard to the story of our Earth.
All right, Brent, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Willow Belden spoke with paleontologist Brent Breithaupt. In our occasional series, Upstarts, we profile Wyoming entrepreneurs. Today, we take you to Teton County, where we meet an entrepreneur who has invented a way to improve your water bottle. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington has more.
Like lots of inventions, Steve Kiddos started with a problem that needed fixing.
I was driving down the road from my house, which was pretty bumpy, but my lid for my water bottle came off and went under my gas pedal. And I immediately thought, why can't I stick a magnet to the lid and make it stick to the side of a bottle?
So the 45-year-old inventor did a little research and discovered that if you did that, you'd have to use a kind of steel that would corrode when coming in contact with your juice or water. You have to add nickel to stainless steel that's going to store beverages. But that also creates a problem.
When you add nickel to stainless, on an atomic level, it actually tweaks the atoms in the steel. It also deflects a magnet.
But that didn't deflect his interest in the idea.
Kiddo just started taking apart all of our water bottles.
That's Steve's wife, Mary. She's a fifth grade teacher at the Wilson Elementary School. She says the water bottles eventually returned home, but with a new twist.
One day he came in and he had done a really rough prototype where he'd taken the lid and added a magnet. And he came in and he showed it and he said, well, what do you think?
That's a loaded question in a household where ideas for new inventions come up so often the couple jokes about the idea du jour.
I tend to knock him down right away. Like, no, no, no. Because it's every day. So, but I like the water bottle. And so he made one for me to start using.
But he told her she couldn't leave the house with it. He wanted to keep the idea secret.
I started the patent process many years ago, and I didn't talk about it very much. I didn't talk about it at all, actually.
Kiddo used to handcraft furniture. Now he drives over Teton Pass every day to get from his home in Wilson, Wyoming, to his shop in Victor, Idaho. He's using a saw to make display signs for his water bottles. His shop has become a warehouse, an office for his new business called Liquid Hardware. Old prototypes litter a drafting table that once belonged to his father.
Being a custom furniture maker, I'm always thinking of solutions to problems and how to make something better.
And he wanted a better water bottle, so this is what he did.
And we're internationally patent pending for adding a ferromagnetic piece of stainless to the outside of the bottle and then adding a rare earth magnet in the lid that's embedded.
So how does that make your water bottle better?
And the two together create an invisible tether for your lid. It's nice you don't have to set your lid down if you're at work or filling it up or drying it by the side of the sink. Once people start using these, they wonder what they did before.
Kiddo was able to turn his invention into a business thanks in part to the internet. About a year ago, he launched a campaign on the Kickstarter website where anyone can pitch an idea to potential investors. He attracted all kinds of small-time hobby investors, including some international ones. Altogether, they pledged more than $10,000 in exchange for getting the first water bottles manufactured.
Kickstarter was a great way to really market test and see what kind of response I was going to get.
After Kickstarter, Kiddo was approached by a manufacturer who makes products for such big-name companies as Apple, GM, GE, and Toyota. Based in China, that company is now making his liquid hardware bottles. He wanted to have the bottles made in the U.S., but the bids he got were too high.
It was going to be about $120 without a lid.
That's per bottle. In contrast, the bottles made in China retail for less than $25 each.
It's going to go out FedEx today to those guys.
He's already sold more than 3,000 bottles and caught the attention of retailers such as South Korea Patagonia, which recently featured his product at a trade show in Seoul. Despite that success, he's still tinkering with his design.
I went to the doctors the other day, and I handed them my Blue Cross medical card, and part of the upper right section is cut out. And she asked me what that was all about, and I said, well, I needed a piece of plastic for my water bottle invention.
Already, Liquid Hardware is gearing up to produce new vacuum-insulated bottles that will keep hot liquids hot and cold ones cold. Kiddo is always inventing, something his wife is obviously well aware of.
It can be maddening, just because it never stops. He's always got an idea, and it's not a typical 8-hour workday. He's not allowed to play with water bottles after 10 o'clock, just because you can hear the dink, dink, dink of the magnet all night long.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
When we come back, we'll have a story on an initiative to be more inclusive of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or questioning students in schools, and an author interview about a book on the life and death of Senator Lester Hunt. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. Schools across the country have embraced sweeping anti-bullying measures in recent years. Universities and school districts are encouraging teachers to celebrate diversity and discourage exclusionary language. But at the upcoming Shepherd Symposium on Social Justice, the University of Wyoming will host a group that says teachers need to be explicit about their acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer or questioning students. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with educators in Laramie about their thoughts on the topic and filed this report.
Well, and I think across the board,
it is my personal belief that anyone getting into education, if you're not there to educate every kid that comes into your room, what in the world are you doing in that job?
In a bustling Laramie coffee shop, Laramie High School social studies teacher Will Plum is chatting with his colleague, Nicole Bondurant, and one of their former students, Nicholas Jesse. The three know each other from LHS's Gay Straight Alliance, a club that functions as a support group for LGBT students and their allies. Nick Jesse was a member, and Bondurant and Plum are co-sponsors. Plum is straight, but he remembers that his peers gave him grief as a kid because he took dance lessons, and his teachers were no help either.
I had teachers say, what are you, some sort of fag, Plum? And I hated education. I hated it. If you had told me at 18 I was going to be a teacher, I would have told you where to go and how to get there, because I could not think of a more vile environment.
Subsequent experience changed his mind, obviously, but not his disdain for slurs of any kind. Plum and Bondurant are quick to admonish and correct students who use derogatory phrases to describe rural people, Mormon people, gay people. LHS graduate Nick Jesse came out as gay when he was a sophomore. Now he's double majoring at UW. Jesse had a positive experience in high school, and he says these teachers had a lot to do with that.
It made me feel like kind of empowered, actually, when they would bring up the fact that, you know, they were against these words and like why you can't use them. And it made me feel like I could be myself just a little bit more.
These are the kinds of results the Shepherd Symposium for Social Justice is hoping for in Wyoming schools. The symposium has invited a group called GLARE, which stands for LGBTQ Advocacy in Research and Education, to encourage future teachers and counselors to integrate awareness of LGBTQ issues in schools. GLARE is based in the School of Education at Brooklyn College in New York.
There's no school that is going to talk about, you know, having second-class citizens, but when we treat certain groups of people as subnormal, you know, it can easily be deducted from the way that people interact with each other.
That's Maria Sharon Del Rio, a professor in the school counseling program at Brooklyn College and one of the leaders of GLARE. She cites national data from the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN, that show more than half of LGBT students often feel unsafe at school because of their sexual orientation, and a third skipped school because they felt unsafe. GLSEN also found that schools with active gay-straight alliances had overall reductions in bullying. Sharon Del Rio encourages teachers to understand and be explicitly supportive of LGBT people, and she wants educators to teach about that population's contribution to society and how sexual orientation is just one type of diversity.
What makes us more effective as future teachers, future professors, future leaders, is to be really comfortable in navigating these intersections, both within the groups that we're part of and the groups that we don't know.
The Wyoming Department of Education administers a questionnaire every other year surveying students about bullying issues. The data shows that bullying in Wyoming high schools jumped 25% from 2009 to 2011 and by 50% in middle schools during that time, but they never specifically asked about LGBTQ issues. Wyoming school safety consultant Bruce Hayes says they will include a question about sexual orientation in their bullying questionnaire this year. As a former educator, Hayes says teachers need to be supportive and protective of all their students, but he's not sure that explicitly focusing on LGBT issues in the classroom will make much of a difference.
I think the jury's still out. Some people feel that it's very important to focus on that group. Other people feel that, you know, we don't need to do that, or that we need to keep an umbrella tolerance of everybody. I think the jury's still out if that's going to be effective or not.
Kim Sorensen, principal of Laramie High School, disagrees. He says, as principal, it's proven very important to be very clear that bullying includes harassing LGBT students. He says openly tolerant teachers, the presence of a thriving gay-straight alliance, and a school policy that explicitly prohibits bullying based on real or perceived sexual orientation has promoted an overall atmosphere of tolerance at his school.
You know, when we go all the way back to Matthew Shepherd, there was bullying and harassing going on here before then. There's bullying and harassing continuing on today. But we have a lot more people aware of the ramifications of that. We have a lot more people aware of how to successfully intervene. We have a lot more people that know what to do if they're a victim.
Sorensen says he'd like to see more teachers trained to be supportive of LGBT issues and more teachers setting an example of respect and tolerance for their students. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
Glare will lead presentations throughout the Shepherd Symposium at the University of Wyoming. The symposium is open to the public and runs April 3rd through 6th.
A longtime Wyoming public official has written a new book about the suicide of former Wyoming U.S. Senator and Governor Lester Hunt. Hunt was a Democrat who was Wyoming's governor for 6 years before getting elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served from 1949 until his death in 1954. In his book called Dying for Joe McCarthy's Sins, Roger McDaniel says that Hunt was well thought of in Wyoming.
In the few short years he had in the Senate, he made quite an impression. He started his Senate career in 1949 by being chosen as one of three senators to investigate Nazi war crimes at the Battle of the Bulge. But then Hunt went on to become a senator who served on more committees than anybody else in the Senate, was appointed to really important panels such as the one that investigated organized crime in America. An interesting episode in his life where he and Estes Kefauver traveled the nation, going to every major city, investigating the mob, had death threats on his life, and it resulted in a commitment from Estes Kefauver's staff that if Kefauver had gotten the 1952 nomination for president, Lester Hunt would have been selected as his vice president.
So we fast forward a little bit, and we get to a situation that involves his son. What happened?
McCarthyism, it turns out, had much more to do with targeting homosexuals or people rumored to be homosexuals than it did with communists. McCarthy could prove little of what he alleged about communists, but when he and Senator Bridges from New Hampshire discovered that homosexuals were employed in the federal government, they conflated the issue of communists with homosexuals by claiming that homosexuals posed an undue security risk. They had claimed that Hitler had assembled a list of American homosexuals with the idea of compromising their loyalty, and that list had fallen into the hands of Stalin, and Stalin was busy recruiting American homosexuals as spies. And so that created this huge outcry that was all a part of the Red Scare against homosexuals. With the pressure coming from Congress, particularly people like McCarthy and Bridges, the District of Columbia Police Force formed what they called the Pervert Elimination Squad, putting hundreds of undercover policemen in bars and restaurants and parks in the District of Columbia. And it was a member of that squad that arrested Lester Hunt's son in June of 1953 for soliciting sex from an undercover policeman. And that started what I describe in my book as the longest year of Lester Hunt's life.
Did he get threatened that they're going to expose his son?
Well, when the charge was initially filed, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the detective involved agreed to dismiss the charge because it was a first charge, and young Hunt was a seminary student, and so they dismissed the charge. And when Senator Bridges and Senator Welker from Idaho learned of that, they initiated a threat to Lester Hunt, saying, if you don't resign from the Senate, we're going to make sure your son gets prosecuted. Hunt refused to resign, saying he wouldn't be blackmailed, and so those two other senators followed through with their threat and used their position to have charges refiled, and young Hunt was tried and convicted. The threats didn't end there, though. Interestingly, Welker was a friend of Red Jacoby, whom most Wyoming people know as the athletic director who did so much to build athletics at the University of Wyoming. Jacoby and Hunt had actually raised the money to build War Memorial Stadium, so they were friends, and Welker and Jacoby had grown up together in Idaho. And so at some point, Welker and Bridges telephoned Jacoby and asked him to carry the message to Hunt that if he didn't resign from the Senate, that they would smear his son's name all over Wyoming. Hunt again refused to resign, announced in April of 1954 that he would run for re-election. But just a few weeks later, in early June, he pulled out of the race, saying that he had health problems and decided not to run. And it was just a few days later that he took his own life.
Do you think he took his own life because of the threats?
I don't think there's any question that it was the threats, and it was the whole whole environment that had been created during that year. His house had been broken in December of 1953 while he and his wife were in Wyoming for the Christmas holidays. Somebody broke into the house and ransacked it. Clearly they were looking for something. The trial of his son was a horrible ordeal. And then all of the political threats that kept coming. And eventually, it was interestingly, I found that the Eisenhower administration in the spring of 1954 had actually gotten involved in the effort to get Hunt out of the Senate. Listeners need to know the Senate was almost evenly divided. There were 48 Democrats and 47 Republicans and one independent. So if Hunt, this Democrat from Wyoming, would just leave the Senate, the Republican governor in Wyoming could appoint a Republican and control of the Senate would shift. There was quite a political need to get that done. And in the spring of 54, someone from the White House came to Hunt and said, if you resign and agree never to run for the Senate again, you can run for governor, but not for the Senate. If you'll do that, the president will appoint you as the head of the U.S. Tariff Commission, which was a job that paid more than that of a United States senator. Initially, Hunt wanted to do that. He was tired of the threats and tired of the pressure. But his wife and his staff said to him, you just can't do that. How would you explain to the folks back home that you got this big job and control of the Senate shifted to the other party? And so eventually he decided not to take the job, and it was just a few days later that he killed himself. And interestingly, the day before he killed himself, Joe McCarthy held a press conference and announced that he was about to open an investigation against a Democratic member of the Senate who he said had been involved in a bribe. And that probably connected back to the early days of the threats when Senators Welker and Bridges claimed that the only reason the charges had initially been dismissed against Hunt's son is that somebody had offered a bribe to the detective. So all of that came together. All of the walls seemed to close in around him, and in that context, he decided to voluntarily end his life.
Dying for Joe McCarthy's Sins, The Suicide of Wyoming Senator Lester Hunt. The author is Roger McDaniel. You're going to release this book on April 2nd at an event at the historic Governor's Mansion in Cheyenne. And then you've got another event in conjunction with that?
We're going to have a mock trial with Dave Friedenthal is the prosecutor. Retired Supreme Court Justice Mike Golden will be the trial judge, and State Public Defender Diane Lozano will be the defense counsel. And Joe McCarthy, Stiles Bridges, and Herman Welker will be tried for their role in the suicide of Lester Hunt. We'll have a jury, witnesses who will play the role of some of the key people involved in the ordeal will take part, and we'll see what the jury decides.
That'll be at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Cheyenne at 1 o'clock on April 7th.
It will. St. Mark's, by the way, was Hunt's church. His daughter was married there. The family were members, and that's where Hunt's funeral was held in June of 1954.
Very fascinating story. Dying for Joe McCarthy's Sins, The Suicide of Wyoming Senator Lester Hunt. Roger McDaniel is the author. Roger, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Roger McDaniel is the former director of Wyoming's Department of Family Services. He served in the Wyoming legislature from 1971 to 1981. He was a lawyer, and he's currently a pastor in Cheyenne.
Every year, the Bureau of Land Management removes thousands of horses from public lands in Wyoming. They ship most of the horses to long-term holding facilities in the Midwest, but that's expensive, and they're running out of space. So now the BLM has partnered with ranchers to create a so-called horse eco-sanctuary right here in the Cowboy State. It's the first of its kind in the nation, Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
The eco-sanctuary is located on a private ranch in southeast Wyoming. Open fields give way to wooded hills. A branch of the Little Laramie River trickles through, flanked by bushy foliage. And everywhere you look, there are horses grazing calmly. Black horses and gray ones, chestnuts and paints. Rich and Jenna Wilson run the ranch. As they drive me around, the horses lift their heads curiously. When we stop, several come over and sniff our hands through the open truck windows. Jenna Wilson says they're nicer looking than she expected wild horses to be.
I guess I was expecting them to be kind of dirty looking and wild and just wild manes with stuff hanging out of them or whatever, and that just wasn't the case. They are pretty.
Rich Wilson says the 228 horses here are all geldings and all were removed from public lands within Wyoming. The BLM routinely removes wild horses to keep herd sizes manageable. They try to find homes for them, but it doesn't always work.
If those horses aren't adopted, then this is where they come and they will live out the rest of their life.
The Wilsons won't train or domesticate the horses, but they couldn't help naming a few, even though one of their contacts at the BLM said not to get too attached. After all, the horses are supposed to stay as wild as possible.
She kept saying, no, you can't get attached to these horses, you know, and make pets out of all of them. And there's just some that they'll just walk up to you, and how can you not pet them and love them?
The Wilsons say turning their ranch into an eco-sanctuary isn't actually that big a change. Traditionally, other ranchers have paid to graze cattle on the Wilsons' ranch. Now, the BLM is paying to graze horses there.
Whether we graze cattle or graze horses, it's just part of the business, and that's what we're doing.
And in fact, grazing horses is financially less risky than grazing cows because the BLM has promised to keep boarding the animals for life. That means the Wilsons won't need to negotiate new contracts each year. Plus, they're planning to start offering tours of the eco-sanctuary this spring, and they're hoping that will bring in some extra money. Diane Schober with the Wyoming Office of Tourism says it's a good plan.
One of the things that visitors do, you know, that's rates high on the list, is the authentic Western experience. And when we say Western, that doesn't mean necessarily just what you would think of in the traditional sense of, you know, cowboys. It's about wide open spaces. It's about wildlife. And, you know, it's great when you have ways that you can really deliver on that promise to visitors.
Schober says having additional attractions in southeast Wyoming, like the horse sanctuary, could prompt visitors to stay longer on their way to the national parks, which in turn could boost the tourism economy. The BLM says the eco-sanctuary will be good for other reasons, too, most notably because they need more space to keep horses. The agency's June Wendland says the BLM removes thousands of horses from the range each year, but at most a few hundred get adopted. As a result, 49,000 horses are currently in long-term holding facilities.
Nationally, we are running out of space in the Horse and Burro program altogether, in our short-term holding facilities and our long-term holding facilities.
To be clear, the new eco-sanctuary can only accommodate a few hundred horses, so it won't solve the overcrowding problem. But Wendland says it's a start, and it'll be good for the BLM's bottom line. The agency pays the Wilsons the same amount they'd pay to keep the horses in long-term holding facilities in the Midwest. But the BLM will get back some of the money that comes in from tourists who visit the eco-sanctuary. And they don't have to pay to transport the horses to the Midwest. Not everyone is thrilled with the eco-sanctuary model, though.
To call it an eco-sanctuary, I think, is really a misrepresentation.
That's Suzanne Roy with the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign.
These are wild horses who have been taken from their natural environment. The stallions have been castrated. The families have been separated. They're no longer able to engage in the type of natural behaviors that wild horses have evolved to engage in.
She says instead of removing so many horses, the BLM should administer birth control to more mares and leave them on the range. It could take years for the BLM to reach its population objectives just through birth control, though. So in the meantime, the agency is hoping to open several more eco-sanctuaries across the West. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, we'll have a story about kids doing yoga. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. Study after study says that children are not as active as they should be, and many groups and organizations are promoting various ways for children to develop a healthy lifestyle. In Laramie, a young woman is trying to do this with yoga for kids. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
It would be difficult to find someone more delightful than Winsome Williams. She's a 22-year-old from Bighorn, Wyoming, who's constantly smiling and projects positivity. She went to India last year to get certified as a yoga instructor. When she returned, she was approached about the possibility of teaching yoga to children. She started last fall in a Laramie school, and now she teaches children in a local studio.
Basically just trying to make it fun, you know? I never want it to be too serious because they are, after all, just little kids.
Williams says her approach is to get the kids excited about something that's healthy for them.
So get them excited about breathing and relaxing and thinking positive thoughts. I think it's good for them to be in an environment where they're dedicating an hour, 45 minutes to cultivating like a healthy lifestyle.
And apparently the kids need it. Isabel is in third grade.
Well, I really like to relax and calm down.
Do you get uptight? Do you get tense?
Yeah, I get frustrated sometimes.
And Amanda is in kindergarten.
I like doing yoga because it gives you relaxations, kind of.
Why do you think you needed to relax?
Because our brains and all of our body can settle down.
This is something Miss Winsome, as the kids call her, hears all the time.
I feel really stressed out from school. I had a really tough day. You know, someone was bullying me or something. So they always have these different ideas of, like, you know, what stress is to them and how they carry stress with them through their day. So it's interesting to hear the different ways that they, reasons why they need to relax.
Let's see.
Oh. Very good. So stretch your leg out long. And now you can come down into a sleeping pigeon. Let's all do sleeping pigeon.
While they stretch and do the things you will do in a normal yoga class, they also spend a lot of time talking philosophically about relaxation and about life. She asks them open-ended questions and is always interested in what they have to say.
You know, we brainstormed some ideas one time of what we could do to unite with nature. And their idea was to go outside and pick up trash and clean it up and, like, to help nature. So it's great. Yeah, I definitely like to incorporate that aspect into it as well.
Adam Henney loves the approach. He's hoping it will teach his daughter some important long-term skills.
Being able to calm herself down and relax. Although the fitness part is nice also, because neither of us her parents are very athletic at all, and we're not giving them that. So it's nice if somebody else will.
Another parent, Frida Knobloch, says her daughter looks forward to the class each week. She's also hoping for some long-term benefits.
The opportunity to be thoughtful in a deliberate way about her life, and you might not think a second or third grader would be capable of taking that kind of pause, but I think they really enjoy it, and if she can make herself feel better on a bad day or a busy day, and she has those skills from the time she's a little kid, I think that's a wonderful thing.
In fact, many parents say their children now do yoga at home and ask them to participate with them. They also say they see a positive change in their children, such as taking time to relax after a stressful school day. This pleases Williams, who hopes she's making a difference in their lives. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And all of our reporters are on Twitter. You can follow us there as well. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.